It's Wednesday night. It's 7 o'clock here on the west coast of the United States, actually, where we find ourselves this evening, I guess. A lot going
David,
on.
We lost it.
What's that, Simon?
We lost it. We lost the line. You got unplugged, and me too, and we went on to somewhere else. And
we're back.
We were not able to get back.
We're back on now.
Yeah.
Couple of things. One is we are on the joy of sacrifice, and we're working with sacrifice number 9. There's some dynamic posts that have taken, that have been put up on the website, which is the wingsofchaos.com. And you'll enjoy what Aria and Jana had to say. And I think they just really got it in a nutshell. You'll see when you get there, you know, read what you can. It's this other camera. Our dear friend Yanesh is still at the hospital, still being tested. She's stable, I think is a good way of putting it. Still in ICU, but fighting spirit and working her way through this particular battle. So, anyway, let's proceed with the chapter. I'll read part of the chapter, and then what we'll do is read some of the things that both Aria and Jana have put up. Okay, so we're going to start then. Let's go over to page 206 in The Joy of Sacrifice by J. Gold. Now, this particular sacrifice is entitled The Sacrifice of Sanity. Then the subtitle is Life of Essence. Interesting, I find anyway, is that the picture is of Samuel Avatar, and he's certainly one to help create the chaos seems to ring. But let's just walk into the chapter. Let's walk into this sacrifice and see if we can find our way around it. So now, and this is how EJ starts, is now. Because what he's saying is we've worked our way through a number of sacrifices. We are not, once again, neophytes. We're working our way through this material. If you are working your way through this material, if this is becoming a tangible method of work for you, what he's indicating is now, at this point, after you've done some of this work, now one goes through the door of the corridor of madness. And what is that madness? It is the undeveloped essence forcefully exploding into the active role of controlling the organism, which up to then has been under the command of the psyche. Okay. I mean, that's the heart of the chapter right there. That's the heart of the chapter. What's occurring here? We've been hinting at this for weeks now. We've been hinting at getting to this place in our work. What's occurring is, how have we set about to learn to live in life? What did we do to get to our place now? How do we go through our day now? How did we learn the things that we know to interact with people, to do our jobs? Where did we learn those? We didn't reason those out. We looked around us ourselves when we were 2, 3, 4 years of age and said, oh, that's how you do it. We just copied. We copied the way that we, how to survive in the world. The machine just copied what it needed to do because its job at the moment when it was doing that was the survival of the mechanism. This mechanism is what is the gift that was given to us on our journey during this lifetime. We were housed in this thing here. We were given that opportunity. And so we come in, and I guarantee you, we come in fully in essence, and I can never forget the moment when my daughter Sarah was born, and that the power of her essence was staggering. That's all. It was just a purity of essence. And for days and weeks, it just was that. And then it looked around and said, how do I then go about living in this world? And learned many things. Now, but we've worked our way through establishing, and here's the key issue, Ivan, is we're beginning to establish a different paradigm here. The paradigm, this is so difficult to understand. The paradigm that we live from is our mechanical paradigm of our life. It's our habitual machine. It is so fundamental to us, we can't even see it. It's so much part of us. This is just what you do. But if you shift paradigms, let's say you go to a different nation or a different type of individual in the United States or Canada or whatever, you'll notice a clash of your paradigms. It's a culture clash, in a sense. Your culture is different than the culture. Now, but what we're talking about is an internal shift of paradigm. Now, let me give an aside here for a moment. The concept of corridor of madness, it's a technical term that is reached after a very sophisticated level of work. It's not something that you choose to do or decide to walk into. In a sense, it's your ordinary life is taken from you. If we look at the Christian mystics, there's just three or four that I'm familiar with is all. But in their life, when they entered what they call the dark night of the soul, they didn't do it willingly. Their path and their spiritual work compelled them to be suddenly in this place where there was their regular paradigm wasn't there. They had nowhere to stand, Ivan. They had no foothold on something. I don't know if anybody has ever done any rock climbing. Years ago, I did a little bit of it, and it was just terrifying to me. But you wind up literally grasping for ledges. And you know, have you rock climbed a little bit? Yeah. And you wind up inches of rock become critical to your survival. And I remember one time I was in Colorado, and I had made a certain movement, and I had no idea how I was going to get out of the situation, and I was physically frozen. So this mechanical paradigm had clicked in that said it's impossible to move now. It literally took me 20 minutes to figure out how to take the next step. Okay? You've been there. And at that point, I had to find a different paradigm to help me just move and recover. By the way, I didn't recover. It didn't work out. I did. But anyway, so the concept is that at a certain point in the work, you don't have a choice. You don't have a choice. The combined forces of your work energy force you into a new paradigm. However, we may or may not be in that position in our work, but it's a tangible reality that in the course of our work, we wind up getting there. And this is where I want to read a little bit from what Aria wrote, and then a little bit later I'll read from what Jana wrote, because what she's saying is so apropos for where our work is now. This is a very momentous sacrifice, number nine. I'm not a numerological person, but...
But you can count to 10.
Maybe. I can get to 9. So she says to us, and you can see this on the wingsofchaos.com, first time I read this chapter, it made my nervous system shake with a stark recognition, yet it had a comforting, consoling effect at the same time, as if this part of me was saying, oh, the corridor of madness, is that what this is? At least now it's identified so I can keep going. So what's happening here? What's happening to this individual?
Orientation.
Disorientation from
where are you? Where am I?
Where am I? But I know.
What am I in?
And this, Ivan, you're gonna click in a minute. I know, because you always do. But you will. So. In essence, she found herself suddenly in a new country. She was on a new land. She was in a new world. And in a sense, she was surprised to find herself there. We've talked about, and I urge you, if you have not, to work your way through the practical work on self material by EJ. And particularly the doorway exercise, what we talked about a little bit last week, the doorway exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept of walking through a doorway, and if you understand this concept and you begin to work with it, you understand that you're moving, and you know, and for me, critical, understanding this idea of transit. You're transiting from one space to another, Ivan. And what happens when you're accumulated work energy, and Aria, this is the hard part for you. I don't know if she's on. Is she, Jenna? Hang on, let me just finish this point and then ask the question, please. The cumulative work energy that you have, that one has, compels them into a place of a moment of certitude where you know you are going to go forward and be in this new space. And being in that new space, suddenly you realize two things. One, you're in totally unfamiliar country, but on the other hand, you know, this smells like home. It smells like home. It smells like this is what I'm meant for. When I, I think I've told several stories about when I met EJ, but there was a time when I was with him in L.A., and we were at a craft fair, and we were working the booth, the Jewels of Ancient Land material. And we took a break. We had been working, as usual, intensely for about 2 days. We take a break, and we go eat lunch in the cafeteria for the convention there. And we're sitting there, and picture this. We are talking about all kinds of stuff, and then he leans forward, and he says, do you want to come and be my accountant? That's my job. My background is in financial accounting. And I knew two things at that moment. One, I knew the expense of that question, what it meant to me. And I knew also, there's no why I knew at the moment, but I can tell you at some point, I knew I was compelled to say yes. Now, here's the point. I wasn't compelled by that individual. This was not an external choice. I was compelled by the accumulated interior work I had done, and that was the reminding factor. And the reminding factor was, say, in essence saying, welcome home. Okay? Now, it took me, I had to wind up my affairs in where I was living in Colorado at the time, but 6 months later I was living in California. And that became the beginning of my riding of the wings of chaos. And you should only be so lucky to be in the wings, in chaotic life, and with someone who's able and willing to keep that going. So, Jana, what's the question?
The ghost?
Yeah.
Like to read a bit more.
Yes, thank you.
Well, have Marvette will help.
Yeah.
You want to see.
Yeah, and you're right about reading from the chapter. It appears as if, now we're talking about suddenly now a new paradigm has come to bear, right? We've left the world of the machine, the comfortable world, and now a new paradigm is there. It's called the life of essence. And we're sitting in the life of essence, and it appears as if a three-year-old has suddenly been put in charge. Sometimes it seems as if one has forgotten everything, even how to think and act. We'll come back to that. Essence is very simple, very important paragraph coming up. It consists of only a very few habits and no more. The essence, unlike the psyche, does not find life difficult or complex. There are few needs of any, desires, aims, achieving, social life, artistic striving, conversations, politics, explanations, all the ordinary aspects of the psyche have fallen away. Have fallen away, and that's because the fundamental paradigm of my ego and my ego survival, my personal ego survival, it ain't there anymore. It's just not there. And what's there is life of the essence, the immediacy of it. Okay? One's actions and speech is taken from the environment and not from within. That feeling and sensing are taken from within, not from the environment. In short, one learns to think with one's feelings. Now, the word one's feelings in this particular concept is not the reactive feelings of the machine. Okay, that we went over in great detail in both practical work on self and in HBM. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about the what we've talked about so many times, this idea of this internal, I call it the essential mood, where you sniff where to go in a different way. You sense your direction, but it comes from what is best described as an inner feeling. We all actually know what that is. We're putting words to it. And in the chapter here, EJ is telling us to look in a different zone now. Look in a different way. Okay? One always speaks about oneself in the third person as an object. The self is the psyche and the I is the essence. One practices by giving the teaching to one's food before ingestion. You begin to realize that food is giving energy to the machine or the human biological machine that allows one to do your work. So you're thankful for that. You're thankful for that energy. By treating food as a living being with full consciousness and awareness who needs and deserves to receive the method before final assimilation. One approaches each task from the point of view of the needs and consciousness of the outer world. one gives running commentary instruction to the body, as if to a computer, and the machine not directly connected to one's control center. So what we have here is, the machine isn't on automatic suddenly. And when the machine isn't on automatic, something else has to come to bear to help give direction. Make sense? So we're not in a reactive mode. We're not saying, oh, what's good for me? Oh, hell, I need this for my own personal ego. I need that. Oh, what about this? What about that? You're sensing the external for purposes of the work before you. It's a different slant. It's a different way of approaching the world. So now we're standing on these little ledges of that we've seen in rock climbing, just barely anything. But it's focusing yourself to actually stand there, to remain there. It's a new foothold. Okay? So one behaves as if one is a commander of a ship and addresses the body and mind as if it were the crew. One assumes an unattached point of view in which one is able to issue directions and instructions for the actions of the body and the mind. So, do you have a sense, does this make sense, Ivan, what we're talking about now, that it's suddenly a different control center, right?
It certainly sounds like a different control center, yeah. Clear on is if that is a three-year-old.
Well,
it appears as if a three-year-old has suddenly been put in charge. In other words, if the essential self is still a baby at this point, maybe it's not. If you've done enough of the preparatory work, but if the essential self is a baby, how is it? In what way is it going to be motivated to give commands? What will is it going to have?
It doesn't
what
have.
Is it going to be,
this is a great.
What is it going to be equipped with?
This is a huge question. It's a very difficult question. It doesn't have the same motives of the machine.
Right.
It doesn't have those anymore. And in a sense, it doesn't care. It doesn't care if this or that or that happens. It's just not part of its to-do list. It's not part of its inventory. It's not there.
David.
Go ahead, Simon.
Yeah, I found very, very compelling that the comment that Ivan said, because I was asking myself the same. I get the idea that it's going to be like a child, that essence, but maybe it has accumulated through the years some habits. And I hear what you're saying too, of course, that doesn't care anymore, but it may be it has developed already some tools that it may not look exactly like a child, but it will be able to function in a society. Although no with all the tools of a personality, but somehow be able to not be so fragile and I guess that's the world, vulnerable in a society, like a child. Somehow this reminds me too with the Toltecs talk of losing the human form.
Right.
Anyway.
This stuff is not black and white either. At the level we're at, it's not black and white. It's suddenly all turned off or all turned on.
Well, I would certainly go along with that one. Because the next question that I have is that, so if the essence is simple,
yeah,
right, and it doesn't have the habits, it hasn't built up in it. The essential self is not imitated and copied and created complexity and so on. That's the psyche or the personality. And
yeah.
That's been built up to survive here.
Right.
So what is it, where does the sense of fear and panic come from?
It comes from the machine.
Where does that, yeah, what is it that remains that's feeling this fear?
Well, it's very similar to if you've ever been in an earthquake. If you've ever been in an earthquake, suddenly you have a tremendous fear because something that you commonly believed was an assumption, which is that the earth is solid, is now no longer there. And there's a terrific panic.
Right. Yeah.
Because you realize, and we should know this anyway, it's nothing is given. The air, the structure of this building, all of it is an assumption. And we carry those assumptions around. And then suddenly, in a certain way, it's ripped from you. It's taken from you. And with Aria, it was taken from her in a certain way. And those are precious moments because then you don't have the old paradigm. That's the whole thing. So that's what's the panic. It's the machine panicking.
Yeah, that's what seems to me it's a mixed. When you're saying, you said something about there being a mixture. You know, there are...
Mm-hmm.
It's like gradation, like EJ talking about grading these coins, like there are gradations of
right. Of
essence, or gradations of identification and disidentification.
Yes.
You know, so, I mean, because I can remember, there are experiences where you feel childlike, where you feel wonder, or it's like you feel like you can merge, let's say, with something larger than yourself. There's very sort of memorable, positive, you know, wonderful experience. And then this is like, you know, when I read what Aria and Jana have written here, it strongly reminds me of essence experiences I have that are characterized by the panic. the panic of the part that says, oh, this is, I'm going to completely lose it. Now I'm not going to be able to walk out the door. I'm not going to be able to put food in my mouth, or I'm not going to be able to
talk
to anybody.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know. And then, there's another one, it seems to me, that goes with that, that I can recall experiencing, which I think is the one that Gurdjieff or somebody calls the terror of the situation, like when you're a little bit removed. You're not identified with yourself, you know, with your personality. So you're somewhat disidentified. And then what you see is the weight, this tremendous, we talked about this a week ago, I think, this tremendous rigidity and the extent of what you've created for the ego, for as personality, you know, like what this whole mechanical realm that's functioning with these personalities. It seems to me that that's seeing that, that's what I, my interpretation of an experience of what the terror of the situation is.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
It's the, I don't know if it's entropy or it's...
Okay.
I was going to mention something that we had in the very beginning in the sacrifice number zero, a reflection, a mirror of this in the sacrifice of peace of mind. I remember that night, man, I couldn't sleep thinking what of my personality, my machine was, you know, in shock of what it was to come. And it was just the sacrifice number zero. That's how I understood it. But I have a couple of comments here.
Go ahead.
From Aria. It says, it reminds me of an attention deficit disorder or ADHD child, but its fixation is not on your usual life's concerns.
Good.
That's what Aurea says. Sinkhog says, all your built-up structures are comfort, and comforts are gone.
They're suddenly gone. And here's the practice. Now, what is our job here? What's our job here as fellows working together? Part of our job is to develop ways and means. Ways and means of making this a pragmatic approach. Now, and both Arya and Janna pointed to moments that they had where they were in this moment of panic. I'm going to call it panic. but what it really is it's a moment of standing on new ground. The result of that is panic, Ivan.
I'm thinking that it's like having one foot on the new ground.
It's one foot on the new ground.
The other foot is still on the old ground.
And you start to feel panic because you actually understand that you can't live that life anymore. That I'll bring at the end of the class there's some important point about that. But you begin to realize that the old life of the machine is thoroughly and potently threatened. Okay? There are barriers to the corridor of madness, just as the corridor of madness is a barrier to the work itself. One may encounter money, attitudes, fears, endurance, impossible teachers, personal interests, the ridicule of others, fears, as barriers, which remain insurmountable. If one is in the least unsure of one's aim in taking the dangerous journey through the corridor. So what is he talking about here, Ivan? What does this corridor represent? What does it represent? And how all of this stuff we have to practice, okay? You will have a moment where the sniff of the corridor of madness is upon you. And your job at that point is to embrace it. You will want to panic and run away from it. But the practice, and this is where we have to get practical and pragmatic, and each of us could declare those moments. You know, every time I sit down, I have a slight panic, the beginning of a panic as to what's going to occur. The panic, because I don't know where it's going to go. Doesn't matter. You say, oh, well, yeah, you do the class all the time, all that sort of thing. It doesn't matter, because the issue is this moment of transit that the machine is going through. And that's what we must pay attention to. Allow ourselves to walk through those moments of transit. And that particular fear has its own scent to it. It's not a human fear.
But the fear of transit?
The fear of entering into the corridor of madness, of being in this other world, has a different slant to it, a different flavor. So when it comes up, part of me welcomes it, because I also know where I'm going to wind up. I know where I'm going to be. I mean, we've all heard the cliche over and over again, and it's true, was true for me again tonight. I was very, very tired today when I came here. I had to start my day very, very early, a lot of driving. And I came back, I was very tired. I didn't even think, I thought I might even not even be able to do this tonight.
Yeah, I think I've been there.
And yet here I am, energetic with no thought of that fatigue.
Right.
What happened to it?
You went through a doorway.
I went through a doorway, and I'm standing in a different place than that fatigue was standing in. Okay? But at the moment, when I felt that fear, that was that fear.
Well, that's the one that the sign on the Hitchhiker's Guide is for, isn't it?
Don't panic.
Arya has invoked Arthur Dent in that post-it note.
Guys, I have a question here.
Go ahead.
Actually, a couple of questions. It says, Seahawk says, does one ever come out of the other side of the corridor? And in quotes, it says, are David and Ivan out the other end? And that's the question of Seahawk. And my question will be, what will be the situation of this corridor? I mean, I hear you, David, and it will be something that it can happen in any moment to us and it disappear. It's just a feeling of panic, and it will go away and we go back to our normal life, and then again here and there will appear again, or it's just at a moment that it continue that state of perhaps madness or instability.
Simon, or is that, are you reading that?
No, that is my question.
Off of Sinhog's commentary.
Yeah, well, this is a very important question, because to me this goes to this issue as to whether these sacrifices in this book, you know, whether we understand them at different levels, or let's say from different perspectives. I mean, we've already accepted we can understand them from different levels. But going back to the other question, I mean, I really can resonate with some of what Arya has written there, because I've certainly had experiences of madness, experiences of being outside of the psyche, let's say, or being lost. Usually, varying degrees of panic and so on. And I would have to say that in retrospect, I mean, looking backwards now, I would say I've had practice runs. It's like I've had premonitions and what would you call that? It's like calisthenics, like practicing the muscles for like false starts, or like when they shoot off this gun in a running race, say, "Oh, somebody jumped the gun," you come back, well, you're going to start again. So those are like the going through the car. Well, those are like entering and going through the corridor of madness, but I'm sure that I've never carried it through. And the reason is because of this other item that David raised, which is in this sacrifice here, in this text of EJ's, that there is no turning. But the definition of this corridor of madness is that there's only the light at the end of the tunnel. There isn't. If you are ejected, if one of these obstacles that he talks about ejects you from this corridor, it's not like you get to start the race again, start the race again, start the race again. He says you must leave the work at that point. In other words, it's another way. Part of what he's saying there is that this process, again, is a buffer. It's a part of the filter and the protection around the work itself and the core of those, let's say, people who are working in essence, which I would say like EJ, you know, those who are teachers, those who are realized, let's say, beings, that, you know, there's a protection there. It's not like just an overnight process. It's not something you just can magically invoke that I'm now going to be in the work. I've met a teacher and so on.
But what you can do, is, what can you do? I don't want this to be a theoretical discussion of the nature of enlightenment and how it is that you become enlightened and all this sort of thing. It's more what can we do where we are now? And Ivan's hitting it on the head. You can practice going through this moment of transit, and once you are in a sense, the state, the life of the essence, to hang out there and know that you're there.
Yeah, I want to have that. Yeah, what I want to practice, I want to know how I can have that 3-year-old-like essential self, you know, do some artwork or work with jewelry or...
And you have, Ivan.
Play basketball.
And the point of it is that you...
What can it do?
It can do all of those things.
Yeah,
and you have done that with music. You've done that. You've done that in conversation, and you've done it in book publishing. Okay, you've done it in conversations with authors.
Well,
where you suddenly break into that other space.
Yeah, well, that I can identify with. There's this item in the telemarketing, this
talk.
Training. When we did it,
yeah.
We did a large, not large, but a fairly intensive cycle of telemarketing. I think maybe you brought this up some weeks ago also. Anyway, there's a wonderful talk, which I need to listen to again. What do you remember what that's called? It's not called the telemarketing
no.
talk, but it has to do with, it's something about the needling of the machine into the waking state, the stimulation of the waking state of the machine, of bringing the essential self into play in this odd sort of unlikely situation, which is conversing on the telephone to another being out there who you just is physically removed. You know, you have this magical instrument like this one. There's one right here.
That's right.
In the room with us. It's this magical instrument that's supplying a link between, in the case of this EJ's talk, it was being communication. It's possible through that sacrament almost, you know, through this magical, what is it? This is a wand. It's like the magic wand. This is like Harry Potter's magic wand.
Yeah.
So this is going to allow me to talk to, I'm speaking to someone, but I'm not just going to speak from my personality to that person's personality. Now there's something, and he talked about, oh, I know, it's called the breath of the essential self. That talk is called the breath of the essential self because the key to this technique that EJ was teaching in telephone work had to do with your breathing, that if you were sensitive to your own breathing and the breathing of the other person on the line with you, that you would perceive when you altered dimensions, when two essential selves were beginning to talk instead of two machines.
There you go, and that's it's the practice.
Yeah.
It's the practice of doing that. When like I do it, I love. That's why I love sales.
Yeah.
And I really like sales. I like the sales environment when
right.
I'm with somebody so that suddenly you get to a place where you realize that you're no longer two beings, in a sense, in adversarial role,
right.
But you're one thing trying to achieve a common goal. And when you know that and you sense that, there's a mood that comes over you, and that's what we're talking about, like moving by feeling. Commanding by feeling.
Right, it is a difference.
As you practice more and more, I guarantee you that, like I know there are some musicians, when they get on stage, there's a moment when they're in the midst of they're busy, but there's a moment when there's a transit to that waking state. And in that moment, there's that initial panic. Sense that, feel that. Know what it tastes like, because it happens in other places too. You're then not dependent on the performance. You can find it in other places. And that's what we're trying to do here, is find moments of practice.
That is, David, what I was going to mention regarding what you are saying, is first, how to recognize those glimpses of the corridor of madness. What are the symptoms that we may be experiencing, and what practically we can do?
Okay. Well,
so how do we recognize the situation, and then what are we going to apply?
Simon, I'll tell you the answer. You reverse engineer it. Okay?
Whoa, is that like UFOs?
You reverse engineer it. When you know you've gotten to the state of the essential self being active and alive.
Right.
Stop and first of all recognize the sense of being in that space and then look back. How did I get there? And that because Simone, you have to find the character, you are the one that has to do hard work for you.
Mm-hmm.
We can give each other hints and describe it. I've described it some of the characteristics for me. There's that little mild sense of fear as you enter into the transit state.
Yeah, but it's true. This is, I think I hear I hear David saying now that everybody's machine is going to have
fundamentally
typicality.
Different.
And so what's different is the chronic defense, what we call the chronic defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is one of the ways to know when this awakening of the machine
is
right,
upon us.
Is just right next door, right there,
yeah.
sort of like at this angle, is because you get plunged into that defense mechanism, whatever it is. I mean, I think for me it tends to be a particular kind of fear and panic.
Yes,
and so,
particular to you.
Yeah, particular to, it's a particular state that I can recognize, but that I don't necessarily recognize.
Well, it depends on what
paradigm. Because the recognition is equivalent to the awakening moment,
And because it's a transit from one paradigm to another.
Right.
And in a certain way, one can't recognize the other.
One can't recognize
that's
the
other. Right.
Yeah, okay,
two different
well,
worlds.
Yeah, see, there is this, I think that there is this, it's truly, it is this, the corridor of madness, it's the transit
yes.
process. There's a necessity, I don't know if it's a necessity, but there seems to be, there's an effect that may not be escapable, I don't know, of being, of having, like, in order to get to the other stream, you have to step into it, and then you have to leave this stream.
Correct.
And so
right.
there's always a part in the process where you're looking forward and backwards. You see, where this is what I'm getting about the panic. You know, well, that's where you need the Hitchhiker's Guide, saying, "Don't panic, don't panic." This is the moment not to panic.
So panic.
Please don't
panic. But panic.
Yeah.
Would be that you eject yourself from the space, and you do that all the time.
I'm sure I have, yeah.
And you have to find ways to not panic even though you're in fear.
You know, actually, I want to go back to Simon's question. I realized that, you know, again, I don't know if Kathy, you know who would know about this whole telemarketing training would be Kathy for sure.
Pip, yeah.
Pip, if she's on there, she could speak to this. But so let me just say, just comment in relation to that. I'll try to be short because we're running out of time. But it happened to me not so long ago that I took a phone call, and it was, guess what? It was a telemarketing call. The guy was calling me about digital from some company in Southern California saying, we want to be your digital service company. You know, we're a complete company. We do everything top to bottom digital. We can convert your books and do your websites, and we do, there's a name for that language, not HTML, but there's a new, you know, universal computer language. So he was telemarketing me. So I told him, I gave him my standard answer, which is to get off the phone with telemarketers. Oh, I'm sorry, we're a very small company, and we do everything in-house, and, you know, we're not putting out 20 or 30 books in the spring and in the fall, so we can't hire people like this. So, and he says, oh, well, what kind of books? He just happened to ask me, like, well, what kind of books are you putting out? And I started telling him about the Book of the Dead or, you know, the Consciousness Classics or something like that. And then he immediately went into, oh, well, you know, I'm a reader of Gurdjieff. And, you know, the guy turned out to be a reader of Gurdjieff and Uspensky and Fourth Wave books, and he wanted to know about the human biological machine. So we got into this whole conversation, which was a completely different dimension. And the thing I realized actually during that conversation is that we were going to that
yes.
place. That the breath of the essential self was kind of, because we've probably stayed on the phone for 15, 20 minutes, whereas, you know, in the usual telemarketer, I'd get rid of them in 90 seconds flat. And this was an unusual event. But so what I just thought of about this is that you can, I can get past that panic thing if the awakening stimulus surprises me, if it takes me by surprise like this. You see, if I can,
good.
If I'm not, you know, stealing myself.
Stealing yourself against
to,
it.
Yeah, to nice. To avoid
allow
going
you,
there.
Allow yourself to be surprised.
So this is sort of like, I think that there is an attitude that can be an attitude that you can take towards just walking downtown, walking through the door,
yeah,
hanging out, whatever you're doing ordinarily, is if you can be open to that moment. the thing can take you by surprise.
And what if you can be open to that moment and surprise more and more and more often? Right now, being open to that surprise.
That's what we're talking about. That's a practice.
That's our practice here.
Yeah.
Now, let me conclude because there's an important point. One must resist madness when in the corridor. One must resist panic when in the corridor. One is sure to be overcome by visions of darkness. There are no side doors or exits except the one exit at the end of the tunnel. As one first enters the corridor, one must see some of the things ahead and may not want to continue. In this case, one must immediately and without hesitation leave the work. This is the last time it is safe to leave the work. And if one continues but not endure to the end, one will never again sleep comfortably or soundly. The madness will not abate, even for an instant, until the end of the corridor has been reached. This warning is always given before one enters. One can never say that one was not told of the dangers before the journey. So, in our case, part of what's happening, and I know some of the people online and in this conversation, the momentum we're gathering is so much that we're beginning to understand we cannot leave the path. We can't go back anymore. There is no turning back. And if you're at a point of not turning back, then you're going to see some things about your own path that are glaring issues. Glaring issues that begin to need to be taken care of. Once you understand you are on the path and you are, from our point of view, well into the corridor of madness, and you're starting to live the life of the bardo, you're living the life of the essence, there's no turning back at that point. There's no more choices of simple choices of life. They become monumental because suddenly those choices are in the context of your work and the work life. And you begin to see in a certain way that your life, and this is dangerous to say, is no longer yours. Your life is for the work, and the work is for all beings everywhere and for the benefit of those beings. And when you begin to sense that, you're done for. It's all over with.
Sounds like the bodhisattva trap to me.
It is.
The bodhisattva trap.
You are compelled at that time inwardly to follow the work. And part of this is to accept that and to accept that reality for yourself. And once you begin to accept that, you begin to surrender. You surrender to the path and begin to surrender a little bit. And you begin to stop arguing about the machines in charge or you're in charge. And I call that the beginnings of acquiescence. And that's why this book is called The Joy of Sacrifice.
Right.
It's the joy of sacrifice, Ivan. You know, we have a joy in sacrificing life on planet Earth for life in another dimension. Okay? What else?
That's a hard act to follow. That's very sobering what you're talking about there.
I have a question here from somebody called Starling, and it says, is this in relationship to the statement that EJ made when he said, you can't change the world, but you can change words.
Hello, starling.
What's that?
Hello, starling.
Yeah, this is what.
And the answer is yes, fundamentally. We know in our heart of hearts, we know in our heart of hearts that this is our destiny. And our destiny is to be, we are called forth to be part of this work. And your form of it is whatever form that is, whatever your contract has been written, and you have signed that contract.
Well, there's also this idea that EJ brought up about changing worlds, which is like the parallel worlds explored. But you see, it strikes me that there may not be any difference between whether the fact that you can change worlds, whether that's symbolic or metaphorical, or whether you really change worlds. There may be no difference between. I'm coming to think that for me, it doesn't make any difference whether we're talking about changing worlds dimensionally, somehow having to do with essence or essence life and so on, or changing worlds to G2783E or whatever that target world is or so on. You know,
there isn't a difference.
We have to consult EJ, but what?
There is not a difference.
No, yeah, I'm thinking right now.
And for
it may not be necessary for me to ask that question.
It's not necessary that there be a difference. And for someone who's able to ask that question and to be in that place.
That person is probably already in the car.
That person is in the flexibility of transit.
Yeah.
And they begin to know that the world we walk in is the barter world all the time. It depends on what paradigm you stand in. And when you begin through practice to stand in the paradigm of the essence all the time, and more and more and more there, then it all opens up in that way. So.
I think, David, in what Ivan was bringing before, if we go back to the exercise of the chronic and the machine, that is, I think, the closest familiar example into this, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. So push yourself in that way and go ahead and read that in both Practical Work on Self and HPM indicates that. But I just wanted to say that that's a great comment, and that's exactly where we should be looking. And unfortunately, we're at the end of our time, and we're being signaled to, but this is the beginning of the next phase of this practice of sacrifice. So I appreciate you coming this evening. Thank you, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week, Sacrifice 10. Thanks, Ivan.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, David, Ivan. Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks, online there.